Rockets of Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. To say that last week was a bad one for Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane would be an understatement. On Tuesday, the state Supreme Court rejected her challenge to the appointment of a special prosecutor who investigated allegations that she had leaked grand jury information. A grand jury's recommendation that Ms. Kane be charged with perjury and other crimes is being reviewed by the Montgomery County District Attorney. By last week's end, Ms. Kane's chief of staff had resigned, and two major news outlets were calling for Attorney General Kane to resign as well. I'm joined now by phone from Harrisburg by 90.5 WESA's Capitol correspondent, Mary Wilson. Good day, Mary.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
How would you characterize the week that was for the Attorney General?
No good, very bad week for the Attorney General. You know, it's been a bad year, you might say, since last year the Philadelphia Inquirer, it was a year ago last month that the Philadelphia Inquirer published this just a bombshell of a report, you know, citing anonymous sources that said Kane had shut down this legislative sting that we then reported on afterwards, a sting that she said had been tainted by racial targeting, among other flaws she saw in this case. And then from there, it just seemed like she could not get ahead of the headlines. She could not beat back this perception that she was in over her head and making questionable judgment calls. So this past week was kind of in keeping with a theme for the past year for the Attorney General.
And it really got bad last week, and it began on Tuesday with the state Supreme Court's rejection of the Attorney General's challenge to the appointment of a special prosecutor who investigated allegations that she had leaked grand jury secrets. What reasons were given for this decision?
This is kind of a tricky thing. So the state does not have an explicit mechanism for investigating the Attorney General. It used to have what was called an independent prosecutor law, and it had it for a short period of time, and it allowed the appointment of an independent prosecutor who could investigate the state's top law enforcement official, the Attorney General, and that was supposed to provide a check on that power, on that office's power, that law expired more than a decade ago. So there's no explicit law that allowed a Montgomery County judge to appoint a special prosecutor who then convened the grand jury began to investigate Kane for leaking secret grand jury information to the Philadelphia Daily News in a bid to, some say, get back at a political foe of hers. So Kane's argument was that because there's no explicit law allowing the appointment of that special prosecutor, the case that he put together against her could not be valid. The Supreme Court disagreed, and they said that although there is no explicit law, it was a valid appointment. Now, as you mentioned in your intro, that case, which did come with recommendations of charges against Kane, including obstruction of justice, official oppression, perjury, and false swearing, all those recommendations and the case itself and the findings go to the Montgomery County District Attorney, Risa Vetri Furman, a Republican who is also running for judge in her county. And she will decide whether to bring charges against Kane. She's deciding now, whether she needs to do further investigation on the case. So that's where it stands now.
And it was interesting to read the comments of the Chief Justice, Thomas Saylor, in rendering his opinion, a 14-page opinion, which came less than 3 weeks after this five-judge panel heard oral argument on the issue in Philadelphia. And to quote what the judge wrote, we view these provisions collectively as affording sufficient authorization to a supervising judge. And in fact, as creating the necessity to appoint a special prosecutor in scenarios in which a grand jury may be considering potential criminal conduct on the part of an attorney for the Commonwealth. What I'm getting from this is that that there is a precedent established for this, but that this is something that you rarely hear about.
Well, sure, and I think the state's attorney general office is not, you know, the history of the state's attorney general office has included corruption, has included questionable judgment from the attorney general. You know, the state's attorney general has been indicted before. That's how we've had, you know, specially appointed attorney generals in the past. But for right now, and that's why we had a law briefly for an independent prosecutor. But we, you know, as I said, the legislature wrote that law to expire after a brief period of time. It expired in 2003. And now that explicit check on the office's power is no longer there. So it's something that the justices are saying is there implicitly.
Now, Mary, on to Wednesday and a Philadelphia Inquirer report. And clearly, the Inquirer has done a lot of legwork. This new report on Wednesday that Ms. Cain had undermined an investigation of a former state gaming official. How did the Inquirer report that this was done? What did the newspaper say?
Citing anonymous sources, the Inquirer reported that Cain had rescinded two subpoenas that were issued to people, one of whom she had political connections to, Louis de Naples, a multimillionaire in Scranton, where Cain is from. He was supposed to be subpoenaed to testify about activity of an ally of his, a state gaming regulator, who the suspicion of the attorney general's office at that time was that the gaming regulator was kind of acting as like an inside guy at the gaming commission for De Naples, who during that time got a license for his casino and then hired that same gaming regulator as an attorney for that casino. Cain, when she got into office and this investigation was going on, she said that prosecutors were being too hard on De Naples and the other person being subpoenaed. And so she, you know, the allegation made by the Inquirer in this report is that she quashed this investigation. So that would be the second investigation that she allegedly quashed for political reasons or even just for judgment that is questionable. Cain, in, you know, to her, you know, Cain would say here that she is not unlike other attorneys general who make judgment calls all the time about cases, and that very frankly, she and her, you know, her attorney has said that there is a group of angry Republican men, and that's a quote, that's out to get her. She made enemies in her, you know, very meteoric rise to political power. She made enemies when she investigated the Sandusky case, which was something she campaigned on. And those enemies are trying to, you know, destroy her career. And so the very run-of-the-mill judgment calls that every attorney general makes, I think she would say here that people are dredging those up to discredit her in kind of the court of public opinion.
We're talking with 90.5 WESA's Capitol correspondent Mary Wilson on the phone from Harrisburg to talk about the week that was a very bad week for Attorney General Kathleen Cain, who's doing what she can to stay in office amid reports, one of which you just heard summarized by Mary from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and, of course, a grand jury's recommendation that Ms. Cain be charged with perjury and other crimes is in the process of being reviewed by the Montgomery County District Attorney. Mary, on Friday of last week, Kathleen Cain's chief of staff, Blake Rutherford, resigned. He only became her chief of staff in December. What happened here?
Well, according to Blake Rutherford, he got an opportunity that he had to take. His wife lives in Philadelphia, and the opportunity was at, you know, a big law firm in Philadelphia. So it was, you know, there was no mention given by Mr. Rutherford that this was that this was because of anything other than just following an opportunity for the pursuit, you know, of, you know, for the sake of his own career. But of course, you know, when you zoom out, the context of this is that Cain's office has seen a lot of turmoil, both among her top aides, and in her communications office in a really excellent profile story, also by the Philadelphia Inquirer over the weekend. Maria Panaritis interviewed Kane and wrote about Kane, and she's got this quote from Kane, who calls herself the Murphy Brown of communications staffers, being playing off the joke from Murphy Brown from the sitcom who couldn't keep a secretary. So this is the larger context of this move, that Kane is a difficult person to work for and can't keep staff.
So that there's a sort of an interpretation out there among some observers that, regardless of what Blake Rutherford said was the reason for his leaving, and regardless of Kathleen Kane's well wishes to him and good luck in the future, that some folks in Harrisburg might be interpreting this as a bad sign that staff members are seeming to be jumping ship, because this isn't, as you pointed out, the only recent departure from her staff.
Right.
Now, the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Harrisburg Patriot News have published editorials calling on Kathleen Kane to resign. Has there been, what has the reaction been to this? And, from your years of observing the comings and goings in Harrisburg, how unusual is this for not one, but two very important news entities, two high-profile media outlets to be calling for someone in a high position in state government to, in fact, leave office before their term is up?
Well, it's significant. It's significant coming from the Philadelphia Inquirer as the paper that's at the front of the herd and, doing, as you said, the legwork to scoop out all these stories about Kane. And it's significant coming from the Patriot News because it's the state government trade newspaper. So it's kind of where you go for the policy minutiae and almost the inside baseball of state government, because it's the one here in town. It's significant. It comes again, like I said, after a bad year for Kane and a bad week. Supreme Court rejects her bid. Philadelphia, one day later, the Philadelphia Inquirer reports that there's another case that she shut down, basically, and it was a case into a political ally of hers who gave her a major campaign contribution, although the contribution is something she gave back later. And then, her chief of staff quit, just a flurry of news that shows an office that where everything isn't hunky-dory.
So what happens next? Where do things go from here? Are we waiting for, is it now just a matter of waiting for the grand jury's recommendation about the perjury charge, the other things that she's being accused of or has been charged with? What is the next date to identify or circle on the calendar?
Well, there's no date that I would circle. Kane says that she's not going to resign. Her attorney and spokesman, Lanny Davis, says that, she's not stepping down. She's not going to give into the fight. The line from her office is that she's under siege by people who don't like her, by people who feel insulted about her rise to power. So that's the line from Kane's office. And in the meantime, like I mentioned, the Montgomery, it's not what a grand jury will decide to do. The grand jury recommended charges against her, and that case file has been sent to the Montgomery County District Attorney, a Republican who is running for judge, who is under political scrutiny herself. Will she decide to press charges against Kane? Will she say that she's going to do further investigation and take a little bit longer? That's what we're waiting for.
And it could take months, conceivably. Is there sort of a ballpark estimate to how long we'll be waiting and how long I'm sure the Attorney General will be holding her breath awaiting a decision here?
We don't have a timeline, no, but the Montgomery County judge has said, these phrases like she'll do, a thorough investigation, a thorough look, a deliberative look at all the evidence. No timeline.
90.5 WESA's Capitol correspondent Mary Wilson joining us from Harrisburg. Mary, thanks for your information. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, it's opening day of the Major League Baseball season and the 50th anniversary of artificial turf. We'll look at how it's changed the game and whether it's being phased out when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. All around the country today, Major League Baseball teams are opening their regular seasons. The Pirates play their opener at 4:10 this afternoon at Cincinnati. That's when the first pitch is scheduled to be thrown. Cincinnati once had an artificial turf field, as did the Pirates, as did a lot of teams. But phony turf, as it's sometimes called, has largely been phased out of the game of baseball. Only two teams still have it. Where did it come from? Where is it going? And more importantly, how has it changed the game? I'm joined now by phone from Chicago by Al Yellen, who writes for the SB Nation Cubs blog, Bleed Cubby Blue, and he's the co-author of Cubs by the Numbers. He's researched the history of artificial turf, which turns 50 years old this year, and joins us by phone from Chicago. Al Yellen, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So where did artificial turf come from? Who brought it into existence and why?
Well, the artificial turf, which is for a long time known as AstroTurf, it was named after the team that first installed it, the Houston Astros. And the reason that the Houston Astros installed it was because they built a dome stadium in Houston in 1965, and they were going to have natural grass in there. They had paint. They had put the glass on the roof, was supposed to be translucent panels, so that light would come in and let the grass grow. Well, what they discovered was that there was so much glare off of the glass that outfielders couldn't see fly balls. So they thought, well, we'll have to paint over the glass. Well, once they painted over the glass, the grass all died. So rather than trying to play on an all dirt field, they, in concert with the Monsanto company, developed this artificial turf that all of a sudden a lot of other teams decided they wanted to use because the maintenance costs were much less than they were on natural grass.
So how fast did artificial turf spread? You know, this was 1965 in Houston. How many years did it take before we saw where I think it was the majority of teams in baseball having AstroTurf, or as they called it here in Pittsburgh, tartan turf, you know, artificial or phony turf?
It wasn't the majority of teams, but there were 10 of 26 teams by the early 1980s that had artificial turf. It started going into places like St. Louis and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, as you mentioned, your own place in Pittsburgh, and Cincinnati. When these cities all built new stadiums in the early 1970s, and one of the reasons they did that was because that was the era of the multipurpose stadium craze. That cities thought, well, we can build one stadium and it'll be suitable for two teams, baseball and football. Well, what they discovered was the one stadium that was supposed to be suitable for two sports wasn't really suitable for either. So the artificial turf was supposed to make it easier for baseball teams, for example, to play on a field right after a football game because the grass would be all chewed up by football cleats. But what they discovered, as I said, is that the stadiums weren't really suitable for either sport, and by the 1990s, baseball teams were wanting their own stadiums and slowly moved out, and many football teams that did leave these multipurpose stadiums wound up building their own and putting natural grass back in, at least in, you know, temperate climates.
And there was a sort of an aspect to the stadiums like Three River Stadium, which it no longer exists here in Pittsburgh, but you had Three River Stadium here, you had Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati, you had Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia. There's the famous quote from Richie Hebner, who played for many years for the Pirates. Do you want to say the quote, or else I can? It's pretty.
I remember the quote very well because Hebner later played for the Chicago Cubs. He said, "I stand at the home plate in St. Louis, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and I honestly don't know where I am. They all look the same."
How did it change the game? How did teams start to build their ball clubs around having this AstroTurf? Because it's not like grass.
Right, and what happened was that teams discovered that you could run faster on turf, and that baseballs went faster when they went off the turf than grass. So it was discovered that if you hit a ball into, let's say, the left center or right center field gap, maybe a single would turn into a double, or a double would turn into a triple. So teams started getting faster base runners and faster outfielders. And so this led to a lot of teams piling up guys who could steal bases. You know, the perfect example would be Vince Coleman of the Cardinals, who stole over 100 bases a couple of years in a row, or Omar Moreno, who played for the Pirates for many years and stole quite a number of bases. So that started what eventually became called Whitey Ball, after Whitey Herzog of the Cardinals, who built teams that hit very few home runs and stole lots of bases and won a lot of games.
And the Pirates, is it safe to say that they benefited from it? Because when the Pirates played at Three Rivers, they played there for 30 years or so. But when they moved in there in 1970, they moved in the middle of the season. The first full season for the Pirates at Three Rivers playing on an artificial turf season was 1971, and they immediately won a World Series championship. Would you say that contributed to their success?
Well, it could have contributed a little bit, although the Pirates at that time were still billed as a power-hitting team with guys like Roberto Clemente and Willie Stargell. They were just a good team. They had contended in most of the 1960s and also in 1970. So the 1971 championship I don't think was totally unexpected, and I don't necessarily think it was directly attributable to the artificial turf. But over the course of the 1970s, the Pirates did start building teams that could run faster on the turf, and they won a number of division titles and, of course, another World Series in 1979.
We're talking with Al Yellen, who is a baseball writer. He writes for the blog Bleed Cubby Blue and is talking with us about the history of AstroTurf, which he has researched and which has turned 50 years this season after it was first introduced at the Astrodome, built in 1965. And at what point, Al, did teams start to sour on artificial turf? What led teams to want to get away from it?
Well, one thing that started it is the move away from the concrete ashtrays, as they used to call places like Three River Stadium. Baseball teams wanted parks that looked more unique, more suited to their own city and their own history. And the first of those, of course, was Camden Yards in Baltimore, which was built in 1992. A lot of brick, a lot of retro steel there, and natural grass. And teams would go in and see Camden Yards and say, "I want one like that." And of course, now you know there are probably almost two dozen teams that have retro parks or similar parks like that. One of them, of course, is PNC Park in Pittsburgh, which I will tell you, I've been to PNC many times. It's probably my favorite park outside of Wrigley Field. They really did everything right in building PNC, and of course, they went from an artificial turf stadium at Three Rivers to natural grass at PNC, and it really blends in so well with the city, and it evokes a historical era of baseball that many thought was lost. And I think that baseball has really gained a lot by the retro stadium craze.
Now, there are still places building new parks, and unlike what has been done in Pittsburgh, which is absolutely brilliant because people here love PNC Park and love going to Pirates games, seemingly whether they are winning or not, which they're expected to do a lot more of this year, winning that is. But as teams decided, like Milwaukee, for example, which built a retractable roof stadium, a lot of the times that roof is closed, but apparently somebody figured out something in the last 50 years, which is how to grow grass under a dome. They weren't able to do it in the Astrodome, but what did they learn about how to do it in places like Milwaukee?
Well, of course, as you say, Milwaukee has a retractable roof. So when it's nice out, they open the roof and the grass can grow. They only really close it when they're playing baseball and it's very cold or it's raining. So they really don't have a problem with growing grass, even in a kind of colder climate like Milwaukee, because they can leave the roof open and the sun can get on the grass. Another stadium that's done something very interesting with grass like that is the, it's not a baseball park, it's the University of Arizona Stadium in Glendale, Arizona, where the Arizona Cardinals football team plays. They literally have planted the grass on a rollable bed, which they can roll out of the stadium and then have a concrete floor where they can have concerts and other events. So that grass stays outside and can grow in the sunshine, and then they roll it in when they need to play football.
And that's where the Arizona Cardinals play. But as you said, there's no baseball team there.
Right.
Football teams all seem to have soured on artificial turf, but there still are a couple of teams that have it. Who are they, and why do they still have the phony turf when everybody else is going to grass?
Well, the two places that have it, first is Tampa Bay Rays, who play in a kind of an outmoded dome in Tampa. That was built to try and attract a stadium way back in the late 1980s when, you know, artificial turf was still kind of a thing. And there's been a lot of problems with trying to get a new stadium for the Rays. The stadium is not built in a very good location for the residents of the Tampa Bay area to get to, and they don't draw because of it. The roof is not retractable, so they can't grow grass indoors. And the only solution really to the Rays issue is to build a new stadium or move, which could possibly happen. In Toronto, the Sky Dome, now known as the Rogers Centre, was built in 1989, again, a time when artificial turf was still sort of in favor. So they built the place knowing that they could roll they literally have the turf in the Rogers Center on little kind of panels where they can unzip it and roll it up, and then they have a concrete floor where they can hold concerts and other events. I have heard, however, that the Blue Jays are trying to work out a system where they can get natural grass in the Rogers Center by 2018. So if they can do that, that would leave just one, the Tampa Bay Rays, with artificial turf. And I think eventually artificial turf will disappear from baseball.
Because as Bill Lee, the spaceman, the legendary Red Sox pitcher, once famously said, if I can't smoke it, I don't want to play on it. That seems to be what the mindset is here for a lot of baseball teams. The interesting thing about artificial turf, though, is that while it is seemingly being phased out of baseball, it as you have written, is gaining some popularity with other sports, particularly in the United States. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, a lot of soccer teams are using artificial turf. It's a thing where, again, it's a maintenance issue that soccer is not a big money sport in this country, so. You know, teams are trying to save money wherever they can, so it's something they don't have to maintain. They can clean it up very easily, and of course, soccer is not the kind of thing where you take the pounding punishment that, let's say, a NFL player would take on artificial turf. And it doesn't have the effect where balls will necessarily bounce farther as they would as baseball teams found out. So soccer players, I guess, will just have to adapt to it.
We're talking with Al Yellen, who writes for the blog Bleed Cubbies Blue and is the co-author of Cubs by the Numbers. So before we wrap this up, Al, you mentioned that your favorite ballpark is PNC Park outside of Wrigley Field. That is your favorite. Not surprised to hear that. A lot of people have a romantic feeling about Wrigley Field because it, for many years, has remained largely unchanged from the way it came into being in 1914, with the possible exception of the lights being added in 1988, which caused a pretty huge controversy. And as people might have tuned in to watch the opening night game between the Cardinals and the Cubs last night at Wrigley Field, they may have noticed a Diamond Vision or video board out in left field where the bleachers are. This has to strike people as being very odd. What is going on at Wrigley Field, and is this taking away from the nostalgic nature of that park?
Well, you know, of course, it is a major adjustment. So were the lights 27 years ago. You know, there were a lot of people who said they would never go to night games. Some of those people actually don't go to night games. But, you know, 27 years after the lights were installed and everybody thought this would ruin the essential character of Wrigley Field, it really hasn't. It's still Wrigley Field with the games played at a different time. The video board, yes, it's different. It's very large. You can't help but notice it. But, you know, in the end, I think it's just another, it's going to be another feature. It doesn't change the, you know, the intimate seating, the closest you feel to the field. It doesn't change the brick and ivy wall. The old center field scoreboard is still there, is still going to be used as it was before. So it will just be an addition. I don't think it will be a detriment. I think people will learn to like it. They do need to make some adjustments maybe on brightness. They need to make some adjustments on some of the information they give. But, you know, it's only been used for one game, so it's hard to tell what the eventual result of it will be. But I think that in the end, people will view it as a positive addition. And in a couple of years, people will wonder what all the fuss was about.
Al Yellen writes for the SB Nation Cubs blog Bleed Cubby Blue and is the author of Cubs by the Numbers. He's joined us by phone from Chicago to talk about the history of artificial turf and its influence on the game of baseball. Al Yellen, it's been a pleasure visiting with you. Thank you so much. And, you know, I say this as a Pirates fan. Good luck to your Cubbies, but not too much luck.
I understand. Thanks for having me. Good luck to the Pirates. They've been doing well the last couple of years after a long time in the wilderness, and believe me, I understand that. So, as I said, good luck to the Pirates, but again, not too much.
Okay, fair enough. Coming up, we'll preview the Pirates season with our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, and we'll meet a Pirates season ticket holder who's missed very few games over the last nearly half century. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today is the opening day of the Major League Baseball season. It's acknowledged by many to be the most optimistic day of the year because it serves as proof that the coming of spring is more than a rumor and that summer can't be far behind. And no matter which team you root for, your team's chances of winning it all are as good as any other team's because everyone is starting with a clean slate. There's little doubt which team George Corey of Homer City, Pennsylvania is cheering for. Mr. Corey has been a Pirates season ticket holder for 46 years, going back to the 1970 season when the Pirates closed down Old Forbes Field and then in the middle of that season opened Three Rivers Stadium. Mr. Corey has just turned 80 years old and joins us by phone from his home in Homer City, just 6 miles south of Indiana. George Corey, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh and happy new season to you.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Do you remember the first Pirates game you ever saw?
Yes. It was 1947. I was 12 years old. I was born in 35. And it was Jackie Robinson's first trip into Pittsburgh. 47 was the first season he played, but this was his first game in Pittsburgh.
So you got your first season tickets to see the Pirates in 1970. Now, that was the first year they moved into Three Rivers. Is that why you decided that would be a good time to start being a season ticket holder?
Yeah, I'd go to Forbes Field maybe 15 times a year from about 1955 when I graduated college, from 1956 to about 1970 when I got my first car and everything. I'd go to maybe 15 games a year at Forbes Field.
Where are your seats located?
Right on the front row on the first base side, right behind the coach's box.
Did you pick that location, or did the Pirates assign that to you?
Well, first of all, when Three Rivers opened, there were a lot of season tickets available. The first year, I was 5 rows back. Then the second year, I was 2 rows back, and the Pirates owned the first row, okay? So I got to know guys like Joe Brown and Joe O'Toole, who at that time was the season ticket manager. Later he became Joe Brown's assistant.
And Joe Brown was the general manager.
General manager, yes. And so I got to know those guys right from the beginning. I got to know the club. They sat in front of me, and we talked baseball the whole time.
Did you know when you first got Pirates season tickets that you would be essentially holding on to them for the rest of your life?
No, I didn't. But I knew I was going to go to most of the games because two reasons. As you heard me, you said my 80th birthday. I'm 80 years old, and I can still drive and see at night. So plus, I like to drive. I've driven over, in those 46 years, I've driven over 390,000 miles from Homer City to Pittsburgh just to go to Pirate games.
That's like an hour each way.
It's an hour and 10 minutes each way, yes.
My God. What makes that worth it to you, to drive to do that, George?
Well, first of all, I'm a baseball nut. I could manage a major league club as well as the best manager in the game. The players, of course, wouldn't play for me, but in baseball, there's only five things you can do on every pitch. You can take the pitch, you can hit the pitch, you can bunt, you can steal, and you can hit and run, okay? And you're not going to hit and run with a guy who doesn't have a chance to steal the base on his own, and you've got a batter up there that swings and misses a lot, okay? And I used to second-guess Leland and Tanner, and LaRussa from St. Louis. I'd be right more than 50% of the time because baseball is a simple game. You can only do five things, and your personnel tells you those. I couldn't begin to be an offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator in the NFL where you have a playbook that's 6 inches high, you know what I mean?
Sure. No, I get exactly what you mean. Well, I understand that you got to throw out the first pitch at a game.
Yes, this 4th of July would be 3 years ago. At Three Rivers Stadium, they asked me to throw out the first pitch, and I said, no, my kids are more interested in that than I am. So at the end of that year, our season always usually ends on a Sunday, our home season. So the Saturday before, he called me, and he said, can you throw out the first pitch tomorrow? I said, my kids would be interested in it more than I would. Let's make it sometime next year and let me know in advance so I can invite my kids. So they're there. He says, okay. So I didn't throw it out then. But then he said, you can throw it opening day next year. I said, opening day, that's for usually a celebrity you have then. He says, well, you're going to be the celebrity. And here I was set up, but that was the year Chuck Tanner died. And Bruce Tanner, his son, was the celebrity that threw out the first pitch opening day. And appropriately so. So he said to me, we'll give you the holiday. So he gave me July 4th. He said, you're going to throw out the first pitch. And that gave me plenty of time to get my kids to come over and everything. And I had about 20 people from my hometown that came.
So when you threw out the first pitch, did you throw a strike?
Yes, I did. From the mound, too.
In 46 years, how many games have you missed?
20.
Just 20?
20, and I've been to 46 All-Star games, baseball All-Star games.
My goodness. Now, who is your favorite player? Out of all the ones you've seen over the years, who is your favorite player?
Three best players I thought I saw were Joe DiMaggio, Willie Mays, and Roberto Clemente. I'd take Roberto Clemente over Henry Aaron any day of the year. Henry Aaron hit more home runs. But Clemente, a guy would hit a single, next guy hit a single. But Clemente would keep him at second, next guy hit a fly ball. That saved the sacrifice fly. Clemente did that more times, saving runs, than Aaron ever drove in runs with home runs. You know what I mean? And he was a much better. Roberto Clemente was the best defensive outfielder I've ever seen in my life.
George Corey has been a Pirates season ticket holder since 1970, and in 46 years has missed only 20 games. He has joined us by phone from his home in Homer City, Pennsylvania. Mr. Corey, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thank you. You're quite welcome. I appreciate you having me.
I Yes, put me in, Coach. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're joined now by our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, who is sports writer emeritus for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and has a video blog called Sportsnet. Bob, good to have you back with us. Happy opening day to you, sir.
Oh, yeah, what a joyous occasion. The game is back. Hope springs eternal. Anything's possible, and people expect them to win the World Series. Woo!
Well, gee, Bob, I detect a note of sarcasm there.
No, a sense of realism, Paul. I mean, you know, to me, if I don't want to know the outcome. I don't care who predicts what. Doesn't mean anything as far as how they what the players expect from themselves. But I like a story. I don't want to know the ending. I want to see the story unfold. And I think this team is certainly the best team they've had since 1992, and I think baseball passions are as high as they've been in those years. And after a long drought, who am I to dampen anybody's spirits?
Well, you know, some might call into question some of the predictions. There are people that are predicting the Pirates will win the World Series, which hasn't happened since 1979. Buster Olney, who is a recognized baseball expert for ESPN, says the Pirates are going to win the World Series, and there are definitely folks who've taken this prediction and run with it. What are the things that are raising cautionary flags for you?
Well, first of all, Buster Olney, a colleague of mine, the Baseball Writers Association, but he's not a pen name for Nostradamus. you know, I go by Nostra Vegas, and they got him at 25-1. And one of 18 teams that has a realistic shot to win it. So, you know, you remember what Casey Stengel said, Paul?
He said a lot of things, Bob.
He said, never make predictions, especially if they involve the future. So, but, you know, this is the kind of fodder. This is the kind of stuff that people just, you know, feed off of. They like to hear that kind of stuff. You know, and you could read Ron Cook in today's paper and say, it ain't going to happen, but enjoy the season anyway.
Well, now, Bob, you covered the Pirates. You were a beat writer for the Pirates for the Post-Gazette, and so you've experienced your share of opening days. The Pirates don't return home until next week. They're opening in Cincinnati, but this is the first game that counts. It happens today at 4:10. So what is it about opening day that makes it special, and do the players and the beat writers and the broadcasters, do they share the enthusiasm that the fans have for opening day?
Well, absolutely, but there's one other overriding factor. It's such a different day that there's no routine to it. And baseball players are notorious for their routines. Opening day of the season on the road and opening day at home will be two atmospheres unlike anything else, because, you know, you walk into the ballpark and you think you're holding hands with your dad and all the generations and friends and family getting together, and there'll be a real buzz about the place.
And you know, there's all this optimism, and everybody's optimistic on opening day because teams start with a clean slate. There are the expectations that are in place for the Pirates, and we've talked about what the media has predicted. So as a keen observer of sports and of baseball, if you break this team down, how do the Pirates stack up with the other teams, with the St. Louis Cardinals of the world and the Washington Nationals, the teams with bigger budgets and maybe a better roster on paper than the Pirates have?
Well, yeah, you know, if you listen to baseball insiders, the scouts, they'll tell you that, hey, the Cardinals are still the example in the National League Central, which is baseball's most competitive, and the Pirates are right there with them, and they've really, their task is to find a way to get over the hump with them, to win that division, to get out of that wild card mode. If they do that, then I think they match up really well with what they can throw out there every day and their pitching staff. However, I mean, just look at the Washington rotation. I'll predict this. The team that wins it all this year will have the best pitching and the least amount of injuries. That's the way it goes. That's baseball. So yeah, there are teams on paper that are
What does Washington have in their pitching rotation? What did they do during the offseason maybe that the Pirates did not do?
Oh, yeah, they brought in a stud pitcher from Detroit. And they've got five really solid pitchers. These are pitchers you've heard of because they're so good. And that's the foundation of any team, any successful team is a pitching staff. So yeah, they're impressive with their rotation, and you know they get some name players like Bryce Harper, and it's a good team, and they deserve, I think, the notion that they're the team to beat in the National League.
And the Washington Nationals have improved themselves. The St. Louis Cardinals are seen to have improved themselves. Olivia on Twitter asks, what happened to the Pirates last year? What do they need to change this year to make it all the way? And I think she means to go all the way and win the World Series.
Yeah, what happened? They ran into a buzzsaw named Matt Baumgartner, and that was just a matchup they can't win in a one-game series. That's why it's so important for them to win a division and at least get, go into the division series where you can showcase your whole team. A one-and-done game, that's, you're playing with too much fire there. So, I think this year you can see a growth in some areas. They're going to miss Russell Martin, but, there's growth in other areas. They got a legit outfield, and probably, from a Pittsburgh point of view, the best player in baseball in McCutcheon. So, they're going to be on a nice little journey. Let's put it that way.
Will they make the playoffs? I know you're loath to make predictions. Will the Pirates make the playoffs for the third year in a row?
Well, certainly, Paul, they have the potential. And, I agree some that, St. Louis isn't going to be the same team either, but I think they've closed the gap and they're right there with them. If they figure out a way to beat the Cardinals, then I think they have the potential to do anything. I mean, let's face it, that's the beauty of opening day. There's the potential for this team to do anything, and there'll be disappointment if they don't, and excitement if they do.
And Max Scherzer was the pitcher, the stud pitcher you were thinking of that went from Detroit to...
Thanks, Paul. The memory is the second thing to go. I forget what's first, all right?
Right. So if we get by the Cardinals, we might... That's the next hurdle with the Nationals and Max Scherzer.
Absolutely.
We're talking with our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, who is sports writer emeritus for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and has a video blog called Sportsnet, previewing the Pirates season. And... you've made your prediction there. So with the minute or so that we have left tonight, the NCAA college basketball men's championship game is being played between Duke and Wisconsin. Wisconsin knocked off the previously undefeated Kentucky Wildcats over the weekend. What do you see happening in this game tonight, Bob?
Well, I would say the smart money would be on Duke and Coach K, whose mother grew up in Keysterville near Uniontown. So, they have a special legacy here. Duke would be, I think, the team where the smart money would go. But Wisconsin's got that. They got a couple of legit players, and maybe mojo on their side. Maybe it's their year. It's those things kind of happen. So I would say Wisconsin is a sentimental favorite, the underdog.
And as far to be fair to the ladies, tomorrow night it'll be Notre Dame versus Connecticut. What prediction do you make there?
Wow, Connecticut is really tough, but I give Notre Dame credit. They've got a tough team, too. I say Connecticut wins, but Notre Dame gives them a real scrap.
Bob Dvorak is sports writer emeritus for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and he has a video blog called Sports and That. He joins us from time to time to prognosticate, and he may not exactly be Nostradamus, but we love him all the same. Thanks, Bob.
Oh, you're welcome, Paul. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to today's edition of Essential Pittsburgh. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to visit past segments, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.